Swimming Against the Current, the Future of Salmon and Other Migratory Fish in Maine. The wild Atlantic salmon, the king of fish, is said to be as old as time. The species once flourished in Maine rivers, which provided the wide, fast-flowing water and rocky beds ideal for spawning. But human impacts, including forestry practices, dam construction, and overfishing, would later conspire against the salmon, which continues to struggle for survival in Maine rivers. I'm Keith Shortall, and today on Maine Calling, we'll get a status report on the Atlantic salmon and on other species of migratory fish in our state. We'll look at the continued threats facing the future of these creatures and find out more about what works and doesn't work in efforts to restore these fish to our rivers. We'll also explore the tensions that exist between the public interest in protecting fish and wildlife and finding cleaner and more sustainable sources of energy. First, this news. From the MPBN studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. For centuries, salmon have helped support rural economies, drawn tourists and fishermen to the state, and have symbolized Maine's natural beauty. But the number of salmon and other migratory fish have been in significant decline. Today, we're going to learn why and what's being done to promote and protect these fish. In the studio with me, Laura Rose Day. She's executive director of the Penobscot River Restoration Trust. Andrew Good is the vice president of the Atlantic Salmon Federation, U.S. Programs. Joining us from our Bangor studio, Catherine Schmidt. She's a science writer and author of The President's Salmon. And as always, we want to hear from you. What steps do you believe should be taken to help Maine's migratory fish? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Our email address is talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome, all of you, to Maine Calling. You know, for years covering this story about the ongoing struggles of the Atlantic salmon, we've joked in the newsroom about wishing that we could interview the salmon. You know, what would they say? What would they tell us? Of course, we can't do that. So the next best source are folks like you who are working on the front lines of this issue every day. But entertain me here, Andrew Good. If salmon could talk, what would they say?
Well, thanks, Keith, and glad to be here. Well, if we were talking to a salmon up in Canada, they'd have a smile on their face. This year's run up in Canada is very good. A lot of those populations, remain healthy. They are sort of some problems. But as you get into the southern range of the species, where we're at here in Maine, we've sort of got a host of problems that really date back a couple hundred years. And so a salmon in Maine is sort of longing for help. They're probably saying, let me back in, because most of their historical habitat in Maine just isn't accessible.
Laura Rose Day, is that what we would hear from salmon in Maine?
Yes, absolutely. The inability of salmon to swim freely to areas that they need, spawning habitat, nursery habitat, rearing habitat, it isn't optional for these fish to get to this habitat, not just salmon, but other sea-run fish like river herring and American shad. They must get to that habitat in order to continue to survive. So I absolutely agree. If I were a salmon, that's what I would say.
Catherine Schmidt, you've chronicled the story of the salmon in your book, The President's Salmon. And it's a story that we often think about and talk about in the context of the changes that happened in the late 20th century, the 1990s, but it actually goes back to the very beginnings of the state, right? It has a long history.
It does. We've been trying to restore salmon for more than 100 years, since the middle of the 19th century.
And so what were the early obstacles that people recognized back then?
Well, they are the same obstacles that we have now. So mill dams associated with early sawmills and grist mills were blocking fish passage. And we have this whole record in the Maine State Archives of people from different towns up and down the Penobscot and other rivers, including the Penobscot Nation, going to the legislature and pleading to have the rivers opened up so that the fish could pass.
Yeah. Joining us on the line now is John Banks, director of the Department of Natural Resources for the Penobscot Indian Nation. John, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you, Keith.
Could you give us a perspective of the Penobscot Indian Nation, of the importance of the salmon and other migratory fish? This is a very old relationship that the nation has.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for having me on the show today, Keith. Yeah, the Penobscot Nation here, we have an ancient relationship with all of the fish species that our tribe has depended on for thousands and thousands of years. And, you know, we talk about the history of salmon restoration here in the state. In our history, we have records of tribal officials going actually to the colonial government in Boston prior to 1820, when Maine became a state. And our tribal officials would travel to Boston to complain about the impacts of the very first hydroelectric dams, I'm not sure that they were for hydroelectric purposes initially, but they did block the migratory fish. And our tribal leaders back in the early 1800s were complaining about fish being blocked and our tribal members not having access to that very, very important source of protein that our members depended on for thousands of years.
Yeah, so historically it's been an important food source? Is that the primary relationship?
A very important food source. You know, after sometimes a very, very tough winter where food stores were getting scarce and the returning runs of all the anadromous fish in the springtime were a very, very much welcomed thing in the spring. In fact, we often held ceremonies to give thanks for the return of these fish every spring.
So, Andy Good, let's come back to where we started off. You said the Canadian salmon might have a smile on their face and say they're doing very well. Not so in the lower range here in Maine rivers, where it's an endangered species. What's at issue here? What are the primary issues affecting the future of the salmon?
Certainly. And just to go back a little bit on the history, if you go back 150 years, it was certainly the main stem dams that led to the big early declines in Atlantic salmon, but it was also excessive fishing. You know, they used to harvest probably a third to a half of that run on the Penobscot were taken, back in Bangor. Certainly pollution was a problem back then. So, you know, we've curtailed the fishing. We've cleaned up the rivers significantly. The log drives have ended. So we have taken care of a lot of problems. We've taken care of the high seas fishery. There is no commercial fishery for Maine salmon anymore off the coast of Canada or off of Greenland. But what remains really are dams. And certainly a lot of these dams now have fishways. But you just can't mitigate when you have too many dams in a river. You can't mitigate that with fishways. So that continues to be a problem affecting Atlantic salmon. Right now, about the 10-year average for adult salmon returning to Maine are about 1,000 fish coming back from their feeding grounds in Greenland each year.
Which is just a very small number when you're considering what's at stake is the future population.
Well, certainly less than 1% of our historic population now returns. I mean, that's one year class. We've got several other year classes in the ocean, but still we're less than 1% of the historic abundance, along with all these other fish they co-evolve with, such as the river herring, the smelt, the shad, striped bass.
Sure. Laura Roseday, then what's happening on the Penobscot? You're part of the Penobscot River Restoration Trust. What's the mission there and the strategy?
Yeah, the Penobscot Trust is working with lots of other private and public partners to open nearly 1,000 miles of habitat on the Penobscot River system. So this is not focused just on salmon, but as Andy points out, all of these other species are extremely important to salmon restoration. And along with salmon getting past these dams, you have all of the other species as well. Prior to the Penobscot project, for instance, below the VZ Dam, only about salmon, for instance, had access to only about 3% of their spawning habitat, and now they are able to access the entire system. The numbers are low, but we expect that this will bring their populations up over time. So the project involved rebalancing hydropower production and fisheries restoration on the river, looking at it as a system. So we had no surprise to work with many different partners, And altogether, we have removed two lower dams, the VZ Dam just above Bangor and the Great Works Dam. At the now what is the only remaining dam on the system between the ocean and waters far inland, there is a fish lift, which is so far successfully passing the fish that we'd hoped. So, for instance, this year, about 300,000 river herring went upriver. Altogether, between a lower tributary and that lift, about 750,000 river herring, which is just an incredible initial success.
So that's a good thing for river herring. Salmon are known for their ability to kind of swim against the stream, and this is what they will do to the point of exhaustion. How are they doing on these passageways, and is that still a barrier to spawning?
Yeah, well, the best passage is for a fish is always in these situations to remove the dam. When you look at a very large watershed, sometimes you have a mix of solutions. So we have the two dam removals, the fish lift, and we're in the process of completing a fish bypass up at the Howland Dam. So altogether, that's what opens up the system. And salmon, we expect to do quite well at all. Obviously, they'll swim past the former site of a dam. They're using the lift quite well, and we expect the same up at Howland. The most difficult fish to pass is the American shad, which is another fish we don't hear as much about, but really played an incredible role in the founding of our country. And they are using the lift at Milford. About 1,800 of them went through Milford this year. So signs of success are good so far.
John Banks, I know you will be leaving us at the end of the segment, so I wanted to come back to you. What more would the Penobscot Nation like to see done to protect salmon or to assure the future well-being of salmon and existence of salmon and other anadromous fish?
Well, I think, now that we've opened up the lower part of the watershed and these salmon have access to more of their spawning grounds, I think some focus in those areas in the upper parts of the watershed, in those smaller brooks and streams where salmon are trying to get to spawn. A lot of times there's road crossings and other barriers on, some of these smaller tributaries. And there isn't lots of effort going on now to try to address these many, many much smaller stream crossings where it's also critical for salmon to access to spawn.
I'll open this up to the group, and it's very speculative, and maybe it's not helpful to the conversation, but I'll take a risk. Let's say we removed every man-made barrier in every river in Maine, every dam, every culvert, would we begin to see salmon come back in the numbers that we once did? The question is suggesting that there are other pressures also happening that we may not have as much control over. Andy?
Sure. The Penobscot historically had 12 different species of migratory fish. So I can say with pretty good certainty that if you removed all the obstructions, 11 of those would rebound very, very quickly. And we've seen that in other places, and we're starting to see it on the Penobscot. However, Atlantic salmon is the toughest one. And because the marine survival has gone down over the last 20 years. Salmon, when they come out of the main rivers, they go over to Greenland to feed, and then they come back. So they have a long migration period. They're not like Pacific salmon where they come back in huge numbers. In the Penobscot, that's the river herring that come back in huge numbers. So salmon, they barely reproduce themselves. And so when you have a downturn, in their marine survival, or you have a downturn in the freshwater, then it gets tougher and tougher. So, it's hard to say. I think what we're doing by opening up their spawning habitat is giving them the best chance they can have. So we're creating the conditions that if things do better in the marine environment, then they'll do better in the freshwater environment.
Yeah, Catherine Schmidt, I know you're more of a journalist than a fish expert, but your treatment of this, you've chronicled the history of it and looked at the pressures that continue facing these fish. What's your take on what could be done to restore or protect the future existence of salmon and other migratory fish?
I do think that the habitat is a huge issue. When you start thinking about marine survival and the changes in the ocean that are affecting salmon and a lot of other fish, it can be easy to feel like there's nothing we can do. But here at home, there's a lot we can do. And by opening up the rivers, even if the salmon don't come back in numbers, it's still really good for the health of these streams. It's good for water quality. And it's good for all of the other fish. So there's really no reason to not do that, because making a stream good enough for salmon is making a stream good, that's good for people, too. So I think those efforts are worthwhile.
We have a listener has asked a question here, which I'll get to before the break. Jim calls to ask, in the archaeological records, there is no evidence of salmon in Maine. Could the guests comment on that? I'm not sure what he's referring to.
Well, I don't think, you know, fish bones don't do particularly well, in terms of archaeological digs. I think there is plenty of evidence that those fish were, you know, in New England, not just in Maine historically, since after the last glaciation.
Right. Well, down into New England, right?
Down into New England.
Connecticut.
Yes.
And...
Yeah, to Long Island Sound, really. It's the Connecticut River historically would have been the biggest salmon run in New England.
Yeah. John Banks, we'll let you go here in a moment, but any final comments here on the...
Well, I think, on that last question of, we can't completely rely on the archaeology record to explain our history. Here in the tribe, we have an oral history that goes back thousands and thousands of years. And, the fact that Atlantic salmon is in our language, our ancient language, there's a word for it. And stories have been passed down over the generations that do document, although orally, the presence of salmon for thousands of years here.
All right. John Banks, thank you for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
John Banks is the director of the Department of Natural Resources for the Penobscot Indian Nation. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your questions and comments join the conversation. The number is 800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Finance Authority of Maine, committed to expanding business and education opportunities by investing in Mainers' success. FameMaine.com.
We stand on the eve of a black revolution, brothers.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with director Stanley Nelson about his new documentary, The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution. It chronicles the rise of the Panthers in the 60s and includes interviews with former Panthers, police officers, and an FBI agent who infiltrated the group. Join us.
And we've been scorned. We've been treated bad, talked about.
And join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. The Common Ground Country Fair in Unity takes place this coming weekend. It starts on Friday. MPBN is once again a media sponsor and will join folks from across the state and around New England coming together to celebrate the rural and agricultural traditions of Maine and, of course, crafts, causes, and cuisine. Many of the voices and faces you know from MPBN will be there to meet you, answer any questions you might have, hear your comments, and give you a chance to try out your own public radio voice in our microphone project. Complete information is online at mpbn.net, including our goal to have 100 worn-out, unwanted, not-needed surplus cars donated to our vehicle donation program by the end of the weekend. We hope to see you there.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, the migratory fish of Maine. How are they doing? In the studio with me, Andrew Good. He's vice president of the Atlantic Salmon Federation, U.S. Programs. Laura Rose Day. She's executive director of the Penobscot River Restoration Trust. And joining us from our Bangor studio, Catherine Schmidt. She's a science writer and author of The President's Salmon. We invite you to join the conversation. The number is 800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We talked before the break, Andy Good, about some of the other species. Salmon, of course, gets a lot of attention because of its protected status, but there are other anadromous fish that live a similar life cycle that are important to the ecology of the rivers and to the state of Maine. What are these other species?
Well, there's 12 different species. Maybe we'll rattle them off. There's an American eel, sea lamprey, striped bass, short-nosed sturgeon, There are, let's see, sea run brook trout. The river herring are comprised of alewives and blueback herring. There's American shad, and I'm probably leaving one or two out. But the foundation of the food chain historically in Maine rivers was the river herring. I mean, they came back in numbers. There was a study that thought at one time there may have been as many as 6 billion river herring coming back to Maine, and sort of that's the ecological foundation. So salmon co-evolve with the river herring with rainbow smelt. When salmon come down after spawning in the spring, the rainbow smelt, they're going upstream. That's what they feed on to rejuvenate themselves before they go back out to the ocean. There's all these relationships. So we found the best way to restore salmon is to restore these other species as well that they co-evolve with. And Maine is a leader on the East Coast. We're the only state with commercial river herring runs and commercial American eel elver runs. We're the only state with increasing numbers of river herring, and that's mostly because we've been opening up the habitat. And my group has worked with the Maine Department of Marine Resources and the federal agencies and others, and we've opened up 18,000 acres of ponds and lakes just over the last decade alone. And the Penobscot run, as Laura mentioned earlier, has gone from 0 to 750,000. It may hit 2 million next year. And we think within a decade, the Penobscot will be the largest river herring run on the East Coast. So there are some good things going on out there.
And what is the, I guess, the effect of that upriver, other than seeing, you know, more of these fish in the water? What are the impacts, the positive impacts that has upstream? Laura?
Well, for the benefits of having removed the lower dams on the Penobscot are they include the fish benefits. So there are people who are catching species that were seldom seen, and certainly not seen in recent history above the dams. So we'll hear of people catching striped bass, for instance, great recreational fish upstream of where the VC and Great Works dams used to be. Beyond fisheries benefits, this year for the first time, the American Canoe Association Whitewater National races were from the Milford Dam down toward the ocean. First time in recent memory that people can actually paddle through these stretches. So there were scores of local businesses and communities that were engaged in what was an enormous event that filled hotels and motels and restaurants. So that is a benefit that extends far beyond numbers of fish in the river. And at Leonard's Mills Logging Museum, which is a living history museum, there is now incorporated in that history that people are learning about the region an alewife run that goes up through a new fishway that Atlantic Salmon Federation and other partners worked on. So the fish are incorporated into the industrial history. And, you know, it really every day, you know, you learn something from someone, a new way they're using the river and something new people are ways people are reconnecting with the river in ways that they simply haven't been able to for a long time.
Catherine Schmidt, as you pointed out, you've chronicled in your book, the salmon has this iconic status. In fact, as the title of your book suggests, the salmon was given annually, a Maine salmon, to the President of the United States until 1992, and that was President Bush the first. What happened? Explain what was happening at the time and why that was the last salmon served to a U.S. president.
There's a couple reasons why the tradition ended. It ended specifically because it had become very political and difficult to actually get the fish to the president, and the anglers were busy fighting proposals for new dams on the river, and we also had a proposal to put the fish on the endangered species list. And so sort of the heyday of salmon angling on the river had passed, and between the political nature of the gift itself and the dire status of the fish at home, it just became not worth it. There was actually a fish ready to go in 1993, and it just we ran out of time. So that's why the 1992 fish ended up being the first. So a combination of fewer fish Endangered Species Act listing and the political hurdles that it took to actually deliver the fish.
And in fact, the Endangered Species Act was
under fire in 1992, wasn't it? At the same time that this fish was being delivered, there were efforts to weaken the Environmental Protection Act, which was an irony.
There was, and that's kind of what I do in the book, is for every fish that was given to a president, I look at the things that were happening in Washington, D.C., in Congress, in the Oval Office, and how they were playing out on the Penobscot and how they were affecting the river and the salmon and the people who depended on the salmon, and tried to make that connection between the things that we vote for and the bills and the laws that are passed and how they really do have an effect at home.
Yeah. The number, 800-399-3566. Let's go to Michael in Westbrook. Hi, Michael.
Hi. Thank you for having this show. It's great to hear. I'm president of the Friends of the Penobscot River, and a number of things kind of come to mind in this that you're talking. But that one of the things is we've been working very much on dam removals and fish passage on the Penobscot, and not all dam removals necessarily result in the ability for fish to come back, because a lot of these mill towns have been so, the rivers have been so altered, that it really needs reconstructive work, too. And so just to put that out there. And then the other thing is to remember that the herring and the smaller fish are really forage stock for the ocean fisheries and also cover stock for salmon, for predators. And so the more vibrant, and I think that was brought up, but the more vibrant your herring population is, to actually better protected the salmon as they migrate will be.
Let's throw the first point out to the group here. Have rivers been altered in such a way that it's affected the spawning capability?
Sure. I mean, down east where we work, back in the log drive day, it's a lot of time a bulldozer would go right down and take the meanders and the bends right out of the rivers so they could get the logs down faster. You know, one of the habitat restoration techniques that's being employed down there is dropping trees into the river. Who would have thought we'd be doing that to try to create habitat, to try to create pools and holding water and things like that. And in some cases, when we're opening up habitat, the fish have been gone so long that sometimes we need to take river herring, and this is Department of Marine Resources, will take them from a nearby drainage and bring them over and stock them into a pond to sort of jumpstart that population with a fish, you know, from close by. So, yes, active restoration is all part of this.
And explain the habitat here. So you need what? It needs to be wide and shallow and fast-moving water, but there have to be places for the fish to leave their eggs. Is that kind of it?
Yeah, they need a variety of habitats. I mean, adult salmon, when they come back, they use the very headwaters of our stream. So they nice, like a nice cobbly bottom. And then when the fry come up, the fry then will move out and they'll move into some of the riffles, or they'll move up into the little small tributaries to feed and hide for a couple years. And then the next life stage is the par. It's a little bit bigger. So they're going out into the deeper water and they're looking for rocks to hide behind. So you need a diversity of habitats for really all these different fish in there.
So
those upper watersheds, so in the Penobscot, just that to the caller's point, the upper watershed was tremendously altered by the logging industry. So just like down east you had bulldozers, up in the West Branch and the East Branch in the late 1900s, or late 1800s, early 1900s, we had people using dynamite to blast curves to get rid of rocks. I mean, we think of the North Woods as being relatively untouched, but in fact, there were people all over the woods, and they really did affect the streams and that headwater habitat through making it so that they could drive logs.
Right. They wanted it to be fast moving and clear of any obstacles, so that the sides were kind of, it was just basically a chute of water coming down, which is not good for the salmon.
Right. And I think go ahead,
Catherine.
The stream banks, you know, they piled up wood along the stream banks that sat there all winter. And so all of that riparian vegetation was affected. And you can still, if you know what you're looking for, you can still see remnant log dams and you can still see evidence of this habitat alteration.
But you both with me in the studio here in Portland are saying that can be addressed, that you can make changes that can sort of address that and fix this habitat?
Well, I think the important message from Michael's point, and I believe it's a way that we're really trying and are successfully leading in Maine, is to understand that these are very site-specific questions. We know that removing dams in lower watershed, lower parts of the watershed is extremely important, and the solution to the best type of fish passage and what you should do at a particular site really depends on a lot of different factors. In the Penobscot project, we were able to both remove dams, increase energy, use a bypass rather than dam removal at one of the sites, and those pieces came together in order to produce the best solution in this place. And that's true at every place that you consider, whether it's a small dam up in the upper watershed or a big lower head of tide dam.
1-800-399-3566. Let's go to Ed in Ellsworth. Hi, Ed.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
On the side of Grand Lake this morning, and of course water's slowly going down because the electric company, takes that through the year to produce electricity. But I was just wondering, Grand Lake is part of the Union River system, and of course other lakes up above that, the Webbs and Molasses and things like that. Any way that we could get more river run herring up here and then back down? I know that during the spring, there's a few trucks that take herring out of the Union River and pump them up in the causeway just past us here. But I really kind of wonder, can any of those make it back down through the two dams back into the river? And other problems, just because we're basically a reservoir for the electric company, and the electric company's lately been keeping water pretty high late in the spring, so a lot of landowners are losing a lot of soil, getting dissolved right out of the beach. And then also we've had in the past terns that would year after year nest out here. They just can't do it because water is coming where they nest. So just wondering if there's some way that folks there with can think of ways to get more river run herring and stuff up into the lake and the watershed system for the Union River. Thank you.
Yeah, okay. Anyone familiar? Yeah.
Sure. The big dam down there in Ellsworth is currently under relicensing, and these dams are all federally licensed for a 40-year or 50-year period. And when those come up, those are where the opportunities are to improve fish passage or other address other recreational issues around that lake. And those are currently being discussed. Certainly, there could be a lot more done in that system for fish passage and for river herring passage. So I think those things are being looked at right now.
But I'm guessing in the current climate, the pressure for sources of energy that are sustainable, renewable, do not pollute the air, those pressures are pretty intense. Is there any possibility of some of these dams being removed in the interest of balancing the future well-being of fish?
Well, that was certainly the beauty of the Penobscot project, sort of creating this balance, working with the hydropower company to allow them to increase energy at other dams while removing some of their remaining dams on the river. So, that's a great model that could be used elsewhere, whether it's in Maine, or in other places. But you're right. But at the same time, changes to the Federal Power Act back in the 1990s allowed the federal resource agencies like NOAA Fisheries and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to have more say in the relicensing of these dams. So there could be a greater balance of, economic and energy production, which is important, along with ecological and recreational uses of these watersheds.
All right. We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, we want to hear from you, and we will hear from Peter and Topsom, among other folks waiting patiently on the phones. The number 800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Casella, committed to increasing recycling rates while reducing residential trash and landfill loads through zero sort recycling. Casella, giving resources new life. And CEI, providing financing and development services for small and medium-sized businesses. Learn more at ceimaine.org.
Pope Francis has not been shy about airing his political views. What will he tell Congress? Thursday morning, we'll have special coverage of the historic address by Pope Francis to a joint meeting of the House and Senate. the Pope's remarks and analysis from NPR News.
And you can tune in for that tomorrow morning at 10 a.m.
On the next Backstory, the Pope's U.S. tour this month includes canonizing missionary Junipero Serra. Many see him as an exemplary Catholic.
Others see him sort of as California's Columbus, as the person who's responsible for all the ills and tragedies of the period of European conquest and afterwards.
A history of Catholics in America, this week on Backstory.
And you can tune in for that program after Maine Calling at 1 o'clock here on MPBN Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the future of Maine's migratory fish. In the studio with me, Andrew Good. He's vice president of the Atlantic Salmon Federation, U.S. programs. Laura Rose Day. She's executive director of the Penobscot River Restoration Trust. And joining us from our Bangor studio, Catherine Schmidt. She's a science writer and author of The President's Salmon. Share your thoughts. How much should or could we do, or the state and federal government be doing, to protect, preserve, and promote Maine's migratory fish? Our number is 800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Peter in Topsom. Hi, Peter.
Good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call. There is a dam between Topsom and Brunswick that has a fishway on it that appears to have been constructed with good intention but crashing ignorance, that is doing more harm to the fish that are using it than anybody ever expected, probably killing most of them because it's way too narrow. It's simply reduced proportionately and therefore is completely useless. And are there other dams around the state that are in a similar situation, and what can we do to fix them? I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Thank you, Peter. I assume there are some fish passage technologies that are better and newer than others.
Yes. The state of the art is a little bit of a misnomer. I mean, we try to retrofit these dams with fishways. And a NOAA fisheries study recently that looked from Maine and up and down the East Coast sort of documented pretty much 100 years of failure overall to restore these feces, these species with fishways. And so that's the problem. However, that particular fishway the caller was talking about was sort of the, quote, state of the art back when it was built 30 years ago. There are discussions to try to fix that fishway, and it may have to wait until the relicensing, but I think there are steps are being – discussions are ongoing now because that fishway is not working.
So properly. When he says it does more harm than good, is it actually killing fish? Is that what he meant? He's gone now. But
well, in the terms of Atlantic salmon, it has been known to sometimes to maybe cause some descaling, as in the turbulence in the fishway. I think river herring are able to get up it relatively efficiently.
All right. Let's go to Peter in York. Hi, Peter.
Yes. I've been working in the alternative energy field since the early 70s, and it seems to me that there's a lot of people out there that are nervous about which way they go displacing hydroelectric. And one way to look at it maybe is that everybody is tending to go toward photovoltaics to get net zero energy homes, and industry will eventually discover that they can increase their profits immensely by putting net zero photovoltaics attached to their industry, either on site or off site and wheeled over. But my big question is, in Brunswick, they have a major fish ladder when they reconstructed the dams down there in Brunswick. And I understand that they truck the fish somewhere rather than just letting them migrate up the river. And I was wondering how the performance of that installation is working out. And of course, the people in that area can add photovoltaics to displace electricity that's made by the facility in the years when the water is not sufficient in the summertime and when the solar is best. So
right,
I'd like to hear some comments on that.
Sure. Who can, Laura, do you know, are you using any trucking in the Penobscot project?
Well, I think that trucking is an approach that needs to only be used when it's supplementing some other plan that's the, you know, like, for instance, dam removals. And there's some temporary trucking that will happen on the Penobscot, but obviously we've removed two large lower river dams, and the idea is to totally open up the system. The Brunswick Fishway we were just speaking of the same fishway, and first I would just want to point out that because a dam is in a particular location does not mean that it's sort of the energy sort of goes to the larger, you know, sort of electrical grid in the sky and is redistributed. So there isn't necessarily a direct correlation to a local area, but the idea, I think, is a very useful one, that you want to look at the range of options that can eliminate the need to use the most damaging forms of energy. The challenge with hydropower is that there are some things about hydropower that are green, but there are also, obviously the entire show is about a lot of negative impact. So I think it's a big advancement that people are actually thinking more about those negative impacts and how they can be reduced. One way certainly to take the edge off the energy equation and the need for hydropower in places where it's damaging is are things like efficiency programs, looking at diverse energy sources instead of just thinking about increasing hydropower.
All right, let's go to David in Freedom. Hi, David.
Hi there. First of all, kudos to Laura Rose Day. Glenn and I have been following her work since she worked at NRCM. And the removal of dams is certainly essential. It's an essential first step for anadromous fishes to get back upstream and even have a chance. But it's only one step. And the thing that I have not heard anyone talk about is watershed management. And I mean, you know, all of the watershed that that supplies water to the Penobscot or any other river is important. And it has been, as you all know, terribly mismanaged over the last several hundred years. And do we have any large watershed management plans? It's not going to help us to get spawners up to the spawning streams if the fry and the parr can't survive in the millions that have to exit these rivers in order for a run to come back.
Yeah, we'll throw it to the group.
Well, certainly the Penobscot, the upper parts of it or the majority of it is heavily forested, and that's really the commercial timber base. And, over the last few decades, there's different certification programs that are going on as well as state regulations. Now, I'd agree with the caller. There's some improvements that could be made, but there are incentives that are in place. And in terms of, say, the road network up in the Penobscot, we do find that through education that the commercial timber base is doing a much better job in putting new road crossings. So they're taking undersized culverts and replacing them with small bridges. So there are some of those improvements that are being made.
I would just add that the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which has already made a tremendous investment in the Penobscot River restoration, recently designated the Penobscot watershed as a habitat focus area. And so they are using all the different offices and parts of NOAA are supposed to come together to look at the watershed to try to make sure that the investment succeeds. And so I think, to get to the caller's point, we will be seeing a little more attention at the watershed scale, and that's something that the Penobscot River Restoration Project really started in looking at the whole system.
Yeah. Laura, did you want to add something?
Yes. Well, I think that there are a lot of different – there are watershed management scale plans in a lot of different places, and one of our challenges is to bring them together so that we can create efficiencies and get kind of the most bang for the buck in the work that we do. And that's happening in a lot of places, but to have a more coordinated way to do that in the state I think would be a very good thing. As rivers are beginning to recover, you know, seeing is believing. And there is really a great citizen movement to be involved in areas that are spread throughout the watershed. People far up the watershed are saying to themselves, oh, well, on the Kennebec River, after the Edwards Dam was removed, now there are there's a great shad fishery at the top of that stretch, but it doesn't really move beyond that because of limitations at the first dam on the river. And people are now feeling, I think, freer to ask the questions that need to be asked about how we make our choices about rivers and dams.
All right, let's go to Frank in Brunswick. Hi, Frank.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, I install small microhydro systems on lakes and also on streams, and there are a couple things in emerging technology that we're quite conversant with that doesn't seem to be going to the people who are more interested in restoring habitat. For example, we're using Archimedes screws to move fish both upstream and downstream, and we even have videos of seals swimming up and down through the Archimedes screws. Another thing we like to use are weirs. Fish can swim over the top of the weir, and what the weir does is draw in a certain amount of water, a portion of the waterway that goes into it. So, and throwing out an odd comment here, which is that I was reading, I try to keep track of what fish are coming back to Maine, and I've given up on salmon. I don't think they're going to ever come back. And I read a very interesting thing that Norway is genetically breeding salmon that do not stray far from off the shores of Norway, and that way they're going to cut down the amount of time it takes to fish for them. I don't know whether these are true or not. But anyway, it's a really interesting kind of development because one of the things I hear from wildlife biologists and fishing people is that, you know, there are very few salmon coming back to Maine, and they seem to be coming back to Canada but not to Maine, and that there's something going on out in the ocean, and it's nothing to do with the shoreline.
Yeah. Well, I'll let you comment on the technology that Frank mentioned, including the Archimedes screw. But what about the bigger statement, I think, which is I don't think we're ever going to see them coming back. I don't want to run out of time here before we can get your sense, each of your senses of where we are here and how hopeful you are that we may see some return of salmon. And Andy, I'll start with you.
Well, you only need to go back to 2011, where all of a sudden marine survival increased in 2010, and we had a big jump in Canada, but down here into Maine, where the Penobscot, the run was well over 3,000 fish, and it showed you that just in 1 year of some improved marine habitat, if you've got the habitat here, the fish were there and we're going to come back. So I think it gave us a glimpse of hope that that we're on the right path here. But you know, I'm not trying to say that salmon are going to be back in fishable numbers anytime soon. It is a long process.
Yeah, Laura.
But we've mentioned several times that we are seeing increases in fish population in populations of other fish. In addition to that, that's extended, for instance, to burgeoning populations of eagles. On the Kennebec River now at the top of the Alewife Run, which is in Benton, there is a commercial fishery. There are festivals around the run. And the eagle population there is now, I believe, the densest eagle population in Maine since like the 70s. So I am glad that folks didn't give up on eagles back when they were in dire trouble. If we know there's something that we can do to give these fish a fighting chance, we believe that we should do it. And we're fortunate that we can do it strategically, and we are finding ways that work.
Yeah, Catherine Schmidt, what's your personal take, or if you'd prefer, your assessment of the conventional wisdom about the future prospects of Atlantic salmon?
Well, I would not give up on a fish that has been here for 12, 14,000 years and is still here despite everything that we've done to it and its habitat. And it retains fragments of that millennia of genetics. And so I would not give up on a fish like that.
There are other that we saw recently, the Danish government, fisheries regulators changing their position in Greenland. There are factors, clearly, though, outside of the United States that could significantly impact salmon populations in the Atlantic.
Certainly, as you know, our fish go to Greenland to feed, and there's been pressure sometimes with the Greenlanders wanting to go back to a commercial fishery that they once had. And we're working hard with another group, the North Atlantic Salmon Fund, and we had a conservation treaty several years back where we were paying the Greenlanders basically not to fish for salmon. That agreement has expired. The U.S. federal government's part of a treaty that tries to control that harvest, and so you know, there are efforts going on to make sure that there is no harvest outside of Maine.
But we often hear this, the strange and mysterious thing happening out in the ocean that's the real problem here. Is there a name for it? I mean, is it just the thing we don't know?
Well, you know,
scientists call it a regime shift.
Regime shift.
Sure. And you know, we see changing temperatures. You know, the reason Atlantic salmon go to Greenland is for capelin. It's a rich, fatty fish, and that's where they can really put on the weight. And because of some of the changes going on in the ocean, the habitat and the movements of capelin and their population is changing. So all these things, you know, the research is starting to tease some of this out so we can see where the problems are so it's not this black hole. We have a lot more information now than we had a few years ago.
Right. It's a complicated thing. Yeah. We're out of time. I appreciate you all being here today. Catherine, Laura, and Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Catherine Schmidt is a science writer and author of The President's Salmon. Laura Rose Day is executive director of the Penobscot River Restoration Trust, and Andrew Good, vice president of the Atlantic Salmon Federation U.S. programs. John Keimel ran the board today. We had additional technical help from Rich Tozier. Cindy Hahn produced today's program. And, of course, the executive producer of Maine Calling is Jonathan Smith. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.